Hey.
Keep calling back.
Thank you. My name is Bobby and I'm an addict.
On mute, Bobby.
Thank you. Can you hear me now? You hear me? All right. Thank you guys for having me. Again, my name is Bobby. I'm an addict. And good morning. It's 8 o'clock in the morning in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's nice. It's 70 degrees. So I appreciate you guys asking me to come out and speak. And Glenn asked me, he told me, he said, the mask must fall. So I hope that I share with you about my journey of how recovery helped me to be myself and to even be a better version of myself. And so I hope I share that with you guys today. I have been clean since October 2nd, 1999, with no drugs, no drinking, no smoking, no pills, no drugs whatsoever to alter my mind or my mood since October 2nd, 1999. And it was not a comfortable ride to be here today. However, I have found many joys and I have freedom in my life that I thought I would never know. I hope I can express that to you today. My English is not so good, even though it's the only language I speak. you know, perhaps I should qualify a little bit and just tell you. So I'll tell you a story so that I could qualify as an addict. I think I was either turning 14 years old or I was turning 15 years old. I can't remember which birthday it was, but I remember my mother asked me, she said, what do you want for your birthday? And by this time in my life, I was getting high every day. And I was getting high with my mother and I said, I want a half gram for my birthday. And she said, a half gram. I said, yes, I want a half gram. And I want to do this half gram all to myself. Like when I used to drink, I used to get drunk and I used to yell bottle to the head. Like that means like drink the bottle all the way, you know, for myself. So I wanted a half gram to the head, you know, just for me. I didn't want to share it. So I was so young at the time that when I got high, I usually just got high with the adults around me. And so that was my hustle. I would play cards. I would play dice and we would sit at the kitchen table. My mom worked at a bar and she would come home at 2 o'clock in the morning and we would all sit around the kitchen table and we would get high. And so she said, okay, well, you show up to the bar tonight at 10 o'clock and I'll give you a half gram. You have to come in the back door. And I said, okay. Well, I wanted this half gram to myself, so I didn't want to tell any of the adults around me why I needed a ride. I was only 14 or 15 years old, so I wasn't old enough to drive a car yet. So I kept asking all these people if they would give me a ride. And they kept asking me why I needed a ride. And I didn't want to tell them because I didn't want to share the drugs. Like, why you got to be getting all of my fucking business? You know, I want this bag, you know? So it was starting to get late and I couldn't get a ride. So I got a screwdriver and I went down the street and I stole a motorcycle. And I rode it to the bar that night and I got my half gram. And So that was a snapshot of how I used, even as a kid, as an adolescent, that's how I was getting high. And so my addiction progressed from there. And before I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, I remember one night I was about 17 years old and I was high as I'll get out. And I was sitting in the living room and I was all whacked out on cocaine. And there was these TV commercials that used to come on, and they were commercials for drug treatment. And I was all high and I was like, damn, these fucking people know I'm high. That's why they're showing this commercial right now, you know? And it was a commercial for a company called Charter Hospitals. And the last thing they used to say before they show the phone number on the TV, they used to say, if you don't get help here, get help somewhere, you know? Well, by this time, at 17 years old, there was all these bikers. Like, there was this famous American biker gang. Probably everybody's heard about them, called the Hells Angels. And my mom let one guy who got out of prison, he lived at the house with us. And so once one biker lives, it's like, once you get one in your house, then the whole house was like that, you know? And so I saw the commercial for treatment. And even by the time I was 17 years old, when I would come down from getting high, I felt like, I don't know, I just would have almost like panic attacks where I would feel tremendously guilty about using. And I knew that, I don't know, I guess I even knew when I was young, I didn't want to keep living like that. And so I wrote down the phone number to the treatment center on a book of matches. And I used to smoke cigarettes, chain smoke. I used to smoke cigarettes like Lucas is sitting over there vaping. Sorry, Lucas. Anyway, so what happened was I couldn't tell anybody around me that I wanted to go to treatment, because in the house I grew up in with all these bikers and criminal type people, if you go to rehab, then that meant like you were a federal agent, you know? So I needed a ride to rehab, and I was trying to ask these people for a ride because the people in the treatment center kept trying to talk me into coming in. And so after not being able to get a ride, I got a screwdriver and I went down the street and I stole a motorcycle. So that was a bit of a theme for me, was stealing motorcycles. But anyway, I drove it to rehab and I showed up there. And in the States, you know, when you're under 18 years old, you're considered a minor. You're not an adult. So they separate the minors from the adults in treatment. And so I was in treatment for a period of time. And I remember after about 3 or 4 days of sleeping, they came and they woke me up and they said, there's a detective outside looking at that motorcycle you came here with. Do you want to talk to that detective? I said, hell no, I don't want to talk to that detective. I said, I'm in rehab, man. We have patient rights in here, you know? And so I don't know how I skated out of that, but I stayed in rehab, and my initial thought, that was the first time I'd ever taking a break from using. And I thought I would just fatten up a little bit and get some rest, and I would go back to the house. And they wanted me to commit to staying there for 30 days. And so after a couple weeks, I started thinking, well, maybe I'll get out of treatment and I'll go tell all the guys at the dope house how great recovery is. And I'll try to save some hoes or something. I don't know what I thought. But I remember the people in treatment being like, that's not probably not a good game plan for you to go back to the same place you were and live with the same people you were getting high with. So this was a long time ago. I'm almost 50 years old now. So I don't really remember how I made it to 30 days in treatment, but I did. And at 30 days of treatment, they offered me to stay for another 30 days. And by the time I'd been there for a month, I really started thinking about what was going to be different, you know? And they said, well, you know, maybe you might want to think about living somewhere else and going into a different situation. So I ended up staying for 60 days. And a lot of stuff changed. You know, during that time, I was the only minor that was in treatment. And all the other kids that were there, how they got to treatment was their parents were like, okay, Johnny, get in the car. We're going shopping. And then boom, the kid was in rehab. And so all the kids that were there were pissed off that they were in treatment. And I was the only kid there that turned himself in. So they used to have, they had family night on Wednesday. And so the parents would show up and all the kids were there and their parents were there. Well, my parents didn't show up, you know, because I was a federal agent. I thought they fed you really good in there, you know, and they took pretty good care of you. So during family night, when all the kids were bitching about being in treatment, I would antagonize them and I would be like, motherfucker, they got Boston cream pie in here. You know, what are you crying about? And so they deemed me untherapeutic for family night and they wouldn't let me go to family night. So this counselor would take me for walks and during family night and he would talk to me. He was an older guy. He was like one of the first people in my life that, I don't know. He took me under his wing and he kept encouraging me about, and he put up with all my antics, you know, even when I was showed up to treatment, I insisted that they did not call me Bobby. They had to call me my street name. And it was Shadow. It was something retarded like that, you know? And, you know, I was so full of shit. I didn't even know I was full of shit, you know? But this guy took me under his wing and he encouraged me. And when the day came for me to discharge or get out of treatment after 60 days, he said, hey, when you get out, he said, you should probably go to a meeting right away. Find people that are in recovery. You should probably stay away from all drugs. That means no drinking, no smoking weed. And by this time, my dad, who lived in a whole nother part of California, they got a hold of him and he had not been involved in my life. And he picked me up when I got out of treatment and he moved me to a whole new part of the state that I didn't know anybody. He was going to put me in high school. So, you know, we talk about in Narcotics Anonymous about changing our playmates and playthings, you know? And so I went to a whole new environment and I got into high school and, you know, I didn't go to a meeting and I didn't connect with anybody after getting clean for 60 days. And every great story starts out like this. There was this girl. And I was in high school and she called me and she lived with her parents too. And she said, hey, I'm drunk. You want to come over here and sleep with me? I said, hell yeah, I'm 17. That's what I do. So I hauled ass over to her house and I knocked on her on their door and her dad answered the door, which was kind of weird. But anyway, so I go in there and I go to her room. And she got drunk and she passed out on the inside of the door, so I couldn't open the door. And I ain't gonna lie, she was kind of heavy. So I was trying to open the door and I couldn't open the door, you know? And so somehow, I don't know how the hell this happened, but I end up in the living room with her dad and we started drinking, you know? And this is after a few months of being clean, you know? And I had this this sinking feeling, you know, inside when I cracked that beer open. That first one, like, I probably shouldn't do this, you know? And next thing I know, we've been drinking, and he pulls out some dope, and we start getting high, and we start talking about how we're going to change the world and how everything's going to be great, you know what I mean? And all this shit, you know, he lied to me for 10 minutes, and I lied to him for 10 minutes, and then we smoke cigarettes for 10 minutes, and then do some dope, and then do it all over again. Then the sun comes up, you know? And, you know, that counselor, to go back a little bit, that counselor, right before I discharged, he gave me this little pocket knife, which I think is weird now, like that a counselor in treatment would give me a pocket knife, because what if it didn't work out? And I was like, look what you made me do, motherfucker, you know? But anyway, I had this pocket knife. And I carried it around with me everywhere because it was very sentimental to me. You know, there was this man and he believed in me and my recovery and he encouraged me to stay clean. And he gave me this little pocket knife and I carried it around with me everywhere. And, you know, I get out of treatment and I didn't connect with people in recovery and it wasn't long before I was sitting in a living room cracking a beer with somebody. And the guy, when the sun came up, the guy I was getting high with, he was like, all right, man, you know, like party's over, it's time to go. And I know he had dope on him. He was like one of those stingy bastards that pretended like he didn't have any more drugs. Like I knew he had drugs, but I also knew he collected knives. So I took out that little knife and it was like a collector's edition knife and he liked it. And then I gave him this knife to give me one more for the road, you know? And when I gave him that knife that was sentimental to me, just to get one more, I had that sinking feeling, man, that feeling like I was giving up something one more time to get high again. And my whole using was like that. I was always giving up a part of me to do something I didn't even want. And, you know, once I opened up that door and I used after being clean for a period of time, I couldn't stop. And, by the time I was 20 years old, I moved from California to Arizona and I had committed a whole bunch of different crimes. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was sent to prison for 11 and a half years. And, you know, I ended up doing 7 years in prison altogether in one shot. I went in when I was 20 years old. And I got out when I was 27 years old. And so I was a young man. And that time was very hard. I used most of the time I was in prison. You know, it's not like, I don't know. There was a lot of rules that were like the street that I grew up in. So when I went to prison, it was natural. I fit right in there. You know, I'm not a big, strong guy, but prison isn't like the movies, you know. I like to joke around and make people laugh, and even killers want to laugh. So they'd be like, Bobby, make me laugh. And I'd be like, okay, don't rape me, you know. So I did okay in prison. But one of the things I knew, or one of the things I learned while I was there was like, most people there were like me. And they were just like petty criminals. And there were some people there that needed to be there. And most people did, for the most part. But most of them were just addicts, man. Most of them didn't even know that they were addicts. And I got in trouble while I was in there, quite a bit of trouble. And I ended up in solitary confinement for almost a year over this assault incident. And after being in the cell for many months, I started to go a little crazy. In fact, one time I was in like an 8x10 cell by myself because I was in there for this assault charge. So they separated me from everybody. So I was in a prison inside of a prison. And because of the way the room is set up, you could only see the room from certain angles. And after months of seeing the room from those angles, I remember, I don't know, I was losing my mind a little bit. So I got naked and I stood on top of the sink so I could see the room from another angle. And I was like, fuck you. I could see the room from a new angle. You can't take this from me. Like, that's how nuts I got. And I don't know where this came from, but I remember I couldn't blame anybody anymore for my using. And I couldn't justify my using anymore. And I was in this cell by myself. And you see, all my journey all the way to this day, it was everybody else's fault that I was there. It was my mom. I got high with my mom. It was the court system. It was a scam, and they made money on me being locked up. And if everybody quit snitching on me, I wouldn't have such bad luck. But there was motherfuckers that snitched on me though, but that's, I don't care anymore. But anyway, my feelings, I had no way to mask my feelings. I had no way to get high. I had no way, to gamble. I had no way to get out of my feelings, and I was overwhelmed, and I got down on the ground. And I put my knees on the ground, and then I laid my face on the cement, and I prayed over and over again. And I said, over and over again, I said, God, please change me. God, please change me. God, please change me. And I said it until I sobbed. And I think that was the very first time that I had got honest. And because I knew it was me that needed to change, that it was not other people's fault. I didn't know. Honesty felt so weird. I didn't know what the fuck was wrong with me. I knew something was, it didn't feel right. But that was the first time, I think, you know, since the subject is masked, you know, that was probably the first time my mask ever fell. And nothing dramatic happened. Like, you know, people pray to God, no burning bush. Nothing fucking happened for years. You know, I got out of solitary confinement. I went on to the prison yard and to the regular population. But I'll tell you what did happen was, everything in prison is a hustle. And you would pay somebody to give you credit for going to programs. And like, you give somebody tobacco or postage stamps, and they would write down that you went to anger management or Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And I walked up to this guy who was sitting on a chair, and I was paying him. And I said, hey, I want to get I need 6 months worth of going to NA meetings. So, because they gave you privileges in prison if you went to programs, you know, and but nobody went. You just paid somebody to say that you went. And I don't know where this came from either. It was like my higher power was with me all through my journey, because left to my own devices, I end up in solitary confinement. So I said to the guy when I paid him, I don't even know why I asked the question. I said, is there even a meeting going on? And he said, yeah, man, there's this guy. He drives up from Phoenix and he sets up a bunch of books and he sits in there for a couple hours and then he leaves. And I was still criminal. I said, really? This fucking guy's got books? I said, hey, I'm going to pay you extra. You go in there and distract the dude, and I'm going to steal his fucking books. He was like, all right. So what I know now that I didn't know then was he was doing an H&I meeting, you know, and he would drive from Phoenix 5.5 hours out in the middle of nowhere to this prison, and he would set up an NA meeting and put all the literature out. But I didn't know any of that shit. I just knew there was somebody bringing books, and I was going to fucking steal them. So I went into the meeting and the guy's talking to him and I'm sticking all these pamphlets in my pants, you know, and I go back to the housing unit and I start and I start reading them, you know. And so that was my introduction to Narcotics Anonymous, was I stole some shit. And so I encourage all newcomers, if you need to steal your shit, steal it, you know. And if you stay clean, you'll learn how to give it back. And anyway, so I had a roommate or a cellmate who used to shoot heroin. And by the time I started reading the literature, I started to think that there might be a connection between me being in prison and me using drugs. But I wasn't sure yet. You know, I mean, that was wild shit. That was wild out the box fucking thinking, because remember, it was the cops' fault and everybody was snitching on me and it was my fucking mom's fault. So, yeah, I was a genius, especially in my 20s. So I had periods of time where I would stay clean in prison and I started reading the literature. And my cellmate, he was a bit older than me. He was in his mid-30s. And it was his third time in prison. And I had a lot of ego. My ego told me that I was the smartest guy in the room all the time. But inside, I always thought that guy was smarter than I was. He had more hustle. He had shit going on for him. When he got out of prison, he had a place to go and he had all these things lined up, and he was a smart guy and he was shooting up. And in prison, you learn how to mind your own business. So when he would shoot up, I would open up these IPs, you know, the Narcotics Anonymous pamphlets. And I would be reading it like this, like, I don't know, you're shooting dope 4 feet away from me. And I remember he was shooting up and it was a homemade needle. It was made out of a Bic pen. So he's bleeding all over the place trying to register before he shot up. And he looks over at his partner and he says, right before he shoots up, he says, yeah, man, when I get out of prison, I ain't gonna fuck around and get high. And then he finishes shooting up. And I was like, this motherfucker used a Bic pen to shoot up heroin in prison, that he paid way too much money for that heroin. And he thinks he's not going to get high when he gets out. I was like, damn, if this dude's smarter than me, I'm in big ass trouble. And it scared me, man, really, because, you know, if I looked up to these guys around me, and they were smarter than I was, and it was his third time in, then what did that mean for me? Like, if something big didn't happen in my life, I was going to spend the rest of my life in there. And so I'm grateful I found Narcotics Anonymous. And I didn't know I was powerless. And in those, in the little IPs in that literature, it talked about powerlessness. And I was powerless, and my whole life was being managed. And so I began reading the literature on a regular basis, and then I went to those meetings where that guy was that was doing the H&I meeting, and he would share, and I was kind of rough around the edges. You know, I didn't have very many social graces. So he would share. He was like an older guy. He didn't look like me. He didn't share stories like I do, but he had been clean for a long time. And I remember he was sharing, and he was talking about, I don't know, he's talking about his feelings or something. And I got pissed off, and I yelled in the middle of the meeting. I go, what the fuck does this have to do with getting clean? Are you going to finally tell us how you get clean? And he was pretty patient, and he got with me at the end of the meeting, and he said, you know, recovery is a process, you know, and what I'm talking about, you're going to learn more about that if you stay around, you know. And he said, it's not like a big secret that we're holding on to, you know. Me learning how to talk about my feelings is how I stay clean. I come to a meeting, I talk about what's going on in my life, you know. And so I have a special love and admiration for people who are of service, who do hospitals and institutions, H&I meetings, and the prisons, for people that can't go to outside meetings. Because, you know, if I didn't have that, I don't know where I would be today. And in reading the literature, I found, like, somewhere in there, I don't know where it says this exactly in the book of Narcotics Anonymous, but it says, Bobby, if you don't go to a meeting your first day out of prison, you're going to die in prison. I think it says that in an NA literature somewhere, but that's what I got out of the literature as I read it. So when the time came, my day came when I was being released from prison. And I was walking out, and I had this cardboard box with my belongings in it. And I'm standing there waiting. And I was excited, man, because I was going to go to a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was standing there, and there was this prison guard. And he told this other inmate, he said, yeah, he said, there goes, but I was a big troublemaker in prison. I know you guys think I was a goody two-shoe. But anyway, I was walking out. And the guy, he pointed at me, and he said, yeah, he said, Bobby, he's not going to make it 90 days. You watch. And I heard the guard say that. And I wanted to say, you know, I wanted to cuss him out. I wanted to say all these things. But by the time I got out, I had about 2 years clean. And what I had learned in the journey of learning about myself was I had learned that that man was right. That left to my own devices, I would not have made it 90 days on the street and stayed clean, because I was always running my own show. And so I kept quiet, because another thing I learned in 2 years of being clean was about anonymity. So I didn't want to say, hey, fuck you, I'm an NA member. And make NA look bad, you know. But, you know, what had happened for me was I had started to experience freedom from myself. And I needed the practice of being on the street to start to break the cycles of using and of being incarcerated and living the same lifestyle my parents did. And however, Narcotics Anonymous gave me the foundation. They taught me that I was powerless over my addiction, and that my life was unmanageable. And then going on through the steps, you know, and I had got up to the ninth step before I got out. And so I got out and I drove and I went to an NA meeting on my way home from prison. And I've been going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings regularly ever since. And I got a sponsor within about a week of getting out. And you know, I can't talk about like the masks falling without talking about how important sponsorship was for me. And I get emotional because I had my first sponsor for 15 years. And when I had came out to Denmark to your convention, it was right after he had died. And I got a new sponsor a week later because recovery goes on. His name was Jeff. And that man, he walked me through all the ups and downs of recovery, from getting out of prison and never having held a job. I didn't have a driver's license. I had never had my own place. I had never had a car. I did not know how to relate to the world. And I trusted him. And I told my sponsor everything. And I love him deeply. And Jeff loved me too. And so I went through the Narcotics Anonymous step working guide with Jeff three times. And in doing all that, you know, I learned a lot about myself. And I remember the first time I did my first four step. This was in prison. I get done with my four step and he said, "Bobby, how do you think your childhood went?" I thought that was a weird fucking question. I wasn't in the step working guide, by the way. So I said, "I think it was all right. Why?" And he said, "Yeah, when you get out of prison, you get a new sponsor. You need to get a second opinion on that." I was like, "Fuck you, whatever." Anyway, so I got to walk through a lot of things in regard to that as well, you know. And I had some anxiety about getting clean initially because I was so young. I was afraid that it was going to change me and turn me into some, I don't know. I thought you guys were a bunch of religious freaks or something. I don't know. But I was afraid it was going to turn me, like it was going to change me. And I'm glad I stuck with the process. I'm glad I got a sponsor and I stayed with the process. You know, I want to tell you one of the very first times I let go of the mask with a sponsor, it was in my first four step and I was in prison and I was going over all this stuff with him. And I kind of told him my four step. And he said, "No, man." He said, "You got to write the questions like everybody else. And you got to answer the four step questions." And I got mad. And we almost got in a fist fight. I said, "I don't understand how writing this shit down is going to keep me clean." And he said, "You don't have to understand recovery for it to work." And so I did it. And I'm glad I did. And I developed a relationship with that man as a result of opening up. Because I had these wild stories about like how it all was on the street. And really, I was just a low level addict, you know. And I was learning how to tell the truth about me and about how using really was, about how I felt, about the places that I took myself, about the ways that I sold myself, about the ways that I lied to myself. It's a long process. And I still have to do that today because I'm delusional. You know, I can rationalize some of the most insane behavior. And I'm grateful that in Narcotics Anonymous, the steps are not a destination. The steps are a journey. You work them. I have worked them several times over. I have a new sponsor. And he'll never be like Jeff. And, you know, when Jeff died, I asked God, I said, please give me the courage to love somebody like that again. And I don't know if that will happen for me, but I'm grateful that I got that close to my sponsor. My sponsor knew in real time what was going on with me because I share with my sponsor a lot. I have a lot of areas I need to grow. And he would say shit to me like he would go. I'd be on the phone and he'd go, just out of the blue, he would go, you got any secrets? Motherfucker. Usually I was like, I always had something juicy because relationships are a whole nother topic. Don't get me started on that shit. Anyway. But I thought that was a very loving gesture that he would just check on me every now and again. You got any secrets? And there was times I was holding out and I would just tell him. And that gave me great freedom. And for me, that's what I did. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps and I have one person I tell everything to, you know. I go to meetings and I share, and there are some things that are appropriate to say at the level of a meeting. And there are some things that you share with your support group, and there are some things you share with a sponsor. And that's how I do it. And you know, I got guys that have sponsors that they don't tell their shit to, but they tell me because they know how sick I am. They're like, I don't co-sign their shit, but well, maybe I do a little bit. That's why they keep coming back. But I just tell them, hey, look, man, you know, we're going to take this journey and nobody does this right and nobody does it perfect. You know, we make mistakes, and having somebody that we're honest with for me is important. And I think that ties in with the topic of letting our mask go, because I have a lot of different faces. I have the face I have at work. You know, I have the face that I have with family. I have the face that I have with my friends, you know, and sometimes I forget which face I'm wearing. And so it's important to have somebody that I'm honest with. And my life is like a dream today. You know, I shared I'd never have held a job. I have never had my own place before. Because of the reason why I went to prison, I was not even allowed to have a bank account while I was on parole. And I rode a bicycle to work, and I lived in a sober living community. And I made minimum wage. And happy as I could be. Because I was filled with hope that as long as I stayed clean through it, anything that comes my way, that it will work itself out. And after all these years, all I have to say about that is it has. It hasn't worked out the way I wanted it to, or how I wanted it, or when I wanted it. But my number one passion, the most important thing I will do today, is to put my head on the pillow clean. I have chased many things. Most of those things wore skirts. But I have chased many things clean. I have chased material things and jobs and education and I'm just glad that Narcotics Anonymous has shown me that staying clean is my greatest priority in life. And I hope that it always stays that way. I got up this morning and I say the same thing I say every damn morning. I say, God, please give me another day clean. Please guide me in my recovery and please show me how to live. I say that every day without fail. And at the end of the day, there's some days when I'm pretty damn proud of myself. And there's some days when I'm like, damn, I got a lot of fucking work to do. And if I don't say that, somebody else will. So, you know, I'm the only one of seven children in my family that's clean. I have a sister in prison. My mother died in a dope house 2 years ago. And you know, I know a love and peace and hope, and I found it here. And I just asked my higher power that that they find that too. And sometimes acceptance is a real bitch. And it's a miracle that I'm here. I wish everybody could know this, you know. I deal with newcomers. I got this guy, I don't even sponsor him. He calls me all the time. And he had just got high, and he's like, I don't know what the fuck happened, you know. And I'm like, what the fuck do you mean you don't know what happened? And he's like, yeah, man, you know, I was doing good. I had 60 days. And then I was like, what do you mean you don't know what happened? And he's like, yeah, it was just the weirdest thing, you know. And I said, well, listen, from what I understand, nobody accidentally gets high, you know. But he's, you know, where he's at in his life, he can't see that he set it up, you know. And so I try to be as patient and loving as I can. And because the level of delusion that I am still capable of is amazing. So, and now I understand, like, you know, like how that the counselor in the treatment center, how he used to put up with my antics of my street nickname, you know, like he was hoping, damn, I hope this dude, you know, I hope this dude does something. And we never know who that somebody is, you know. And I'm grateful that I found this program. And I'm, you know, what happened was, I told you I was afraid it was going to change me. And my fears came true. I got to become a better version of me. And I hope that for everybody that enters Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm trying to think of some more really awesome shit to tell you, but I can't think of anything else. I don't know how much time I have, but anybody should show up some fingers. One finger for 5 minutes, two fingers for 10 minutes. I don't know how much time I have. Oh my God. Somebody's put it up two hands. You guys are killing me. I got some Starbucks right here. I'm halfway. If I get all the way here, you're going to be like, when is this guy going to shut the fuck up? Anyway, where I'm at today, I'm going to be 47 years old. To me, that's almost 50. And I'm grateful, man. Now I think about stuff like, I think about how come the hair is falling off of here and growing out of my ears. That's one thing. But like, I think about, you know, my legacy, like what I'll be known for. I missed a big part of my story was telling you, like, right before I went to prison, 4 months before I went, I had my only child. Her name is Kira, and she's 26 years old. And I got out, and against all odds, I went to see her my first day out. And it was very difficult. You know, when we first get clean, there's a lot of wreckage we have, some more than others. And, you know, I wanted the love and affection right away. I was like, hey, when I was in prison, when I first got clean, I was like, you know, I changed, you know, I've been clean 30 days. Send me a money order. So when I got out, you know, and I saw my daughter, her mother would not let her stay the weekend with me for almost a year. And I just kept showing up and showing up and showing up, you know. Narcotics Anonymous taught me how to do that. We just show up, regardless of how we feel. I felt an immense amount of shame, of guilt. I felt like my problems were so big that I could not overcome them. I did not have a driver's license. I could not have a bank account. I didn't have anything to drive. I stayed in a halfway house in the ghetto. And when I finally got a job, it was for minimum wage. And then how do you look at your kid who was 4 months old and now she's 7 years old and you were gone that whole time? How do you make up for that? And my sponsor said, you don't. And that was hard. It was hard to keep showing up. But I went and I saw her, and about 9 months later, I remember I was driving my truck down. I was driving a truck from a guy that I sponsored. He let me use his truck because I went from riding a bicycle. My very first vehicle was a $500 motorcycle and it had a big dent on the right-hand side of the gas tank. So when I pulled up to NA meetings, I would make sure the dent was facing the wall so nobody could see my dented motorcycle. You know what I mean? Because I'm a pimp. And so I remember the very first time, you know, this is showing up and this is not quitting 5 minutes before the miracle. I was driving down the road, man. 9 months I'm showing up and it hurt my fucking feelings because not only did her mother not want her to spend the weekend with me, my daughter did not want to come spend the weekend with me. I didn't know that for a while. I didn't find that out for about 6 months. And I'm so self-centered, you know, I could have made that whole thing about me. And I did, but I called my sponsor first and I told my sponsor how upset I was about that. And I was like, what the fuck, you know? And then my own kid doesn't want to see me. She brainwashed my child and blah, blah, blah. You know, I had this big story I told myself. But instead of going to her mother with that or going to my daughter with that, I was new in recovery. I was new to the street. And I needed to share that with somebody who had more experience than me. I picked my first sponsor, Jeff, because I thought he was a good parent. And he had many years clean. And he was very active in Narcotics Anonymous. So I trusted him on what he thought about parenting. And he said, listen, he said, part of your amends, because I did a four-step with him and I did a lot of dirty stuff to my child's mother. And he said, listen, if you go to her and you tell her and you try to apologize for how you behaved, you're probably going to harm your relationship with her. The best way for you to make amends is to show up, don't say anything negative to her, and be there for your daughter and do that consistently. And so I did. I never said a foul word to my child's mother. And she just passed away a couple of days before Christmas. And anyway, so 9 months of showing up and keeping my mouth shut, I'm driving down the road in this truck and my daughter unbuckled the seatbelt and she laid her head in my lap and she went to sleep. And that was the first time she relaxed around me. And I felt it. And I fucking cried almost all the way across town. I was trying not to wake her up because I'm an ugly, loud crier. And, you know, it's like moments like that. You know, it's like all that work that it takes to be a better version of ourselves is not comfortable. And then you have a moment like that. And it was beautiful. And then from that time on, you know, I could tell my daughter was more comfortable around me. And it stayed that way. And that was work I had to continue to do, you know. And eventually I became a weekend father. She would stay with me on the weekends. I had got an apartment. I had got a car. But it started with staying clean no matter what, and riding a bicycle to meetings if that's what I needed to do, and talking to my sponsor regularly. And I'm so grateful for that, because what I got to do was I got to have a relationship that I probably didn't even deserve to have. You know, I had accepted when I got clean that it was very likely I would not ever be able to make amends. But I stayed clean anyway. I accepted that I may not have my daughter in my life ever, that my ex was never going to like me or be with me again, that the people that I lost their trust, I would never gain their trust. And I had to make a decision, was I still going to stay clean? And I don't know. The alternative was I could keep going on, like we say in the reading, is we could go on the best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death. And I had decided that I don't know what recovery is going to give me, but I'm going to check it out. And I'm going to stay clean, because staying clean can't be as bad as my using was and all the consequences that came with it. And so the first mass that fell was when I very first admitted I was an addict. The big next step, though, was surrendering to the things that I would need to do to stay clean. Because when I was on the street, I remember I ripped some guy off. I was that guy. I remember I used to be the guy when I got high. Everybody could give you, you know, everybody put together their money and they would give it to me and I would go get the drugs. And I was the guy that came back. I was always the guy that came back. And then one day they put together all the money and I go to get the fucking drugs. And, you know, I only needed to try a little bit of it. I don't want to come back to everybody and the drugs weren't good. So I needed to try them out first. You don't want me to be selfish. So I started doing the dope. And then next thing I knew, I was barefooted in a trailer in the middle of summer with no air conditioning and no more dope. I don't know why I always ended up barefooted towards the end. But you know how they say this soap, this dope is so good, it'll knock your socks off. Well, it used to knock my fucking socks and my shoes off. So I don't know. I don't know why I told you that. But anyway, once I became the guy that did not come back, I never came back, you know, and I did a lot of dirtbag shit. And, you know, that weighed on my self-esteem for a long time. And by the time I got clean, I had my gas tank was empty. I didn't care about myself. In fact, I was clean 7 years before I finally went to a dentist. I got a bunch of damn feelings over that. A lot of metal in this mouth. So, you know, self-care and all those things, I didn't feel like I deserved it for a long time, you know. So I'm grateful I found the program in Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, I think the first two things for me that stand out the most were being able to admit that I was an addict and accepting what I would have to do to stay clean. And, everybody that has shown me, nobody has ever led me astray, you know. My sponsor wasn't always right, but he was most of the time. And no direction he ever gave me harmed me, you know? And, you know, I love Jeff. And I thought I had a really great relationship with him. Actually, the first 2 years he sponsored me, I didn't even think he fucking liked me. And he would do shit. Like I would be talking to him on the phone and I would say, I've been thinking. And right before I would finish what I was saying, he would just hang up on me. He'd say, you think too much. He didn't want to hear what the fuck I was thinking. But over the years, I developed this great relationship with him. And he's an older man. He's older than me by about 20 years. And he had beautiful teeth, beautiful. And I said, I used to ask him, I go, man, you got great teeth, man. I don't know why. I think because my relationship was so good. I said, are those teeth real? And he said, yeah, motherfucker, these are my teeth. I was like, all right. Well, Jeff Thornton, I can call him by his full name because he died clean. He died on his 38th anniversary. He was in the hospital. He had liver cancer. He wanted to be transported to his house. They said, you're not going to make it through the night. They transported him to his house. Everybody was around him, the people that loved him. It was like a small group, you know, and he laid there. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning when he got home, about midnight. It was on his 38th anniversary. That was March 1st, 5 years ago. And he was laying in his chair in his living room and they gave him his 38-year clean medallion. And he put it in his hand. And then he, you know, looked at everybody. Then he pulled his teeth out. He put him on the tray and he turned over and he died. Motherfucker. I knew him 15 years, and he never admitted that he had fucking false teeth. Believe me, after he died, I noticed he took them out before he fucking died. He used to always say, as we learn better, we do better. So anyway, if you're new to the program, you know, we talk about keep coming back, you know, and there's things that we do here that help us stay here. You know, I hope I shared some of that with you guys today. And what a privilege it was to meet with you guys today. I will always remember my trip to Denmark. I will always remember how hospitable you are. And see, you guys knew me before Trump was president. So don't fucking judge me. And I hope to see you guys again. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you very much, Bobby, for carrying the message of Nakajka Nominus. I think you should give him a hand before we end this meeting. If you unmute, everybody.